This is an RTRFM podcast. RTRFM is a community organisation and relies on volunteer and listener support. To learn more about what we do, visit rtrfm.com.au.
In the early hours of August 27, 1925, hundreds of glamorous couples foxtrotted the night away under the domed roof of Government House in Perth. They were gathered for the St. John of God Hospital Gala, a charity event frequented annually by the city's young and wealthy, who donned their best suits and evening gowns and danced to a live orchestra, playing the best of the roaring 20s, including Gladys Moncrief's Follow Yvette. The room was a cacophony of sound, full of so much chatter and celebration that no one noticed a young woman make her way through the crowd. She eventually reaches a young couple and taps a suited man on the shoulder. She's dismissed, and the young man turns to continue dancing. Then a shot. The crowd grows silent, then curious. It was normal for police to be roving events like this, to temper the often rambunctious youth. Was this a prank? Was someone playing a joke? A dancer nearby is hit by a bullet casing. The young man clutches his head and draws bright red blood. No, this was no laughing matter. This was murder on the dance floor. Perth is one of the most isolated cities in the world. So far removed from the rest of the globe, it might as well be its own planet. Join me, Jeff Bullen, as I take a deep dive into the weird, wacky, and unexplained history of our eccentric city, digging up memories of bygone icons, personalities, and events. This is Planet Perth. Can't contain my excitement today. Not only are we back for a new season of Planet Perth, but we're kicking off our research with a visit to the State Records Office to catch up with senior archivist Damien Hassan.
This is a little bit later. This is like a year after Cyril Gidley was murdered, and his father's writing to the WA government to say...
Over the last several months, Damien has been helping us unpack the ballroom murder, and today he's invited us to the state archives.
Fortunately so, because now we get to see them. Yeah. They're here, they're preserved, they're part of the story that we can tell about this whole incident.
When we walk in, we're overwhelmed by hundreds of archive shelves, which concertina in and out to reveal thousands of documents. It was within one of these thousands of files that local historian and author, Dr. Lee Straw, discovered the bullet that shot the man at the beginning of our story of the ballroom murder. An intriguing case that is still shrouded in mystery.
It's a great local story. There's a lot of questions about the murder itself and the outcome of the trial. And so it kind of was, boiling around in the back. And I just thought in a recent couple of years that I wanted to put that story together.
Dr. Lee Straw is an associate professor in history at the University of Notre Dame. And though she's written many books about women and crime, she was captivated by the fateful night 25-year-old Cyril Gidley was shot dead by his ex-fiancée, Audrey Jacob.
The relationship was over, but Audrey was still carrying some affection for Cyril, or perhaps she was distraught by what had happened in their relationship, and she breaks down on the evening of the 26th of August, goes back to her accommodation at the Surrey Chambers, which is unfortunately was knocked down years ago, and she goes back to her accommodation there, where she's been living for a few weeks, gets a revolver, goes back to the ballroom, and shoots Cyril dead on the dance floor.
All of this unfolded against the backdrop of the so-called Roaring Twenties. But as Dr. Lee says, this was not quite the reality for little old Perth at the time.
Well, I mean, we talk about the 1920s in terms of that, you know, that general term of the Roaring Twenties. But the reality is that the Roaring Twenties was probably more a bit of fiction anyway in Fitzgerald's creation in the United States. But we're bang in the middle of the 1920s, where Perth itself is not really a city. Like, it's regarded as a metropolitan area, but it's really a big country town if we were to look at Perth compared to Sydney or Melbourne, for example. I think the attitudes were still kind of a carryover from the Victorian period. You know, we might well talk about, as I said before, the flappers and the 1920s and, you know, all that's associated with it, and women gaining a bit more independence. And they were. They were gaining more independence through different work that was available. They were also, there's a growing sense of women's identity and you know, sort of emphasising that a bit more. But as I say, it's still pretty conservative in the 1920s. And so this case was sensational because not only was there a murder on the dance floor, but you have Audrey, who was a young woman who's meeting men on ships, and she's very independent, and conservative Perth kind of struggled with that at the time. So I think that while there's emerging independence that's coming through, we're still pretty conservative.
Dr. Straw's account of the ballroom murder has given us new and nuanced understanding of this story and the main characters, Audrey Jacob and Cyril Gidley. So who were they? Damien Hassan helps us understand the couple just a little bit better.
So she was born in Vic Park. She had seven siblings. She was the second oldest. So quite a big family. The father worked in the courthouses. He was like a registrar of the courts. So, you know, they probably weren't that wealthy. It would have been quite a lot of mouths to feed. She's such an unlikely figure for, committing this act. She was always considered quite a, you know, well, she had a very strong artistic temperament. So she did a lot of painting. She did reasonably well at school. No criminal record before this. So, yes, she was a local. Cyril Gidley was actually from England. He came from a place called Grimsby in England and had worked as a sailor, coming across eventually to Australia, then got a job as an engineer on the State Shipping Service. And he'd been working state ships for about 2 years when this incident happened. So he was frequently on the SS Kangaroo, which would make this round trip to Singapore. That was kind of his day job.
Now, betrothal seems to be the big thing back in that day. I mean, both Audrey and Cyril had been engaged previously as well.
Yeah, so Audrey was 20 years old when this incident takes place. Cyril Gidley's 5 years old from her. He's 25 when he gets shot.
So young.
Very young. So when Audrey and Cyril get engaged in October 1924, wasn't actually Audrey's first engagement. She had actually been engaged to another sailor.
My goodness!
Who was away at the time when she gets engaged to Cyril Gidley.
What a player!
Later on, when she moves to Melbourne, she gets engaged to another fellow, and that gets broken off very quickly, and then she meets a quite wealthy American businessman later in 1925, and they end up getting married and settled down. But she was known to visit the ships in port at Fremantle. That's of major concern to her parents. And her parents, in fact, go to the Fremantle courthouse in May of 1925, and they meet with a female constable, Constable Chipper. And this is all on one of the court, one of the Crown Law files, and they express their concerns about Audrey and her behaviour, that they believe she's out drinking and socialising to the late hours and visiting these men on ships.
Yeah.
So they're very worried about what might happen there.
Now we know the main players in the case, I'm sure we're all dying to know the details of the crime and the crime scene.
So she had gone with a female friend of hers, and she was dressed as a pirouette. So that's kind of like a, you know, a pantomime figure in...
With the full face paint?
Yes, that's right. A bit like, David Bowie in the Ashes to Ashes video. So you can sort of picture that. She goes dressed in that costume because it was a fancy dress
My
costume.
God, that gives it a slightly spookier edge.
So this character is, you know, typically known as sort of a sad clown. So she goes as dressed as this sad clown. She sees Cyril Gidley. She feels very hurt and upset seeing him, and she leaves the ballroom and goes back to her apartment. Actually, not too far away. She was staying at Surrey Chambers in St. George's Terrace at that time. Surrey Chambers has sadly been knocked down because it was such a beautiful, ornate building. She goes back there, and according to the testimony in the court case, she decides to end her life. So she has a revolver at her apartment, and according to the testimony, she was intending to walk to the river to take her life. She, in fact, heads to the Catholic Church, which is a completely different direction to the river. And then it's stated that something overcame her, this sort of peace overcame her, and she decided not to carry on with that act. She went back to her apartment, but as she was walking back, she went past the Government House ballroom, and she decided to go in and try and make peace with Cyril Gidley.
With a revolver in her hand.
Yes. Well, again, according to the testimony, she was in this kind of trance, and she said that she wasn't aware that she actually had this revolver. So she was walking in. She sees one of her friends who says, oh, could you let Cyril know that I'm here? And he chooses not to go and speak to her. So a little while later, he sees her dancing. She sees him dancing with one of his female friends, and she taps him on the shoulder, and Cyril says, not now, I'm dancing, and that's when she shoots him. So she may have been aiming for the heart, shooting him through the heart, but he turns at the same time, so it takes out part of the lower aorta, perforates his lungs, and he puts his hands to his head and collapses, and immediately, you know, he's hemorrhaging a lot of blood, so blood is frothing at the nose and mouth, and he dies within minutes.
Wow. That's a very big turnaround from making your way to the Catholic Church to put yourself on the end of a revolver to that action.
Look, it is, and you know, according to her testimony, she still feels like she's in this kind of trance, not really aware of what she's doing. Police then start to approach her, and someone says, look to the woman in the blue dress. So I forgot to mention, when she went back to Surrey Chambers, she changes out of her fancy dress costume and gets dressed in this beautiful peacock blue dress.
With the makeup still on, or did she remove the...
I'm not sure. The records don't say. So, yeah, she's then taken into custody. Now, this murder was witnessed by there were hundreds of people still at the ballroom at that time at 1:30 on Thursday morning, 27th.
Were any of the police armed? I mean, surely armed with a revolver, there would have been people thinking that she was going to fire again.
So there's a doctor that approaches this melee initially, and he takes the pulse of Cyril Gidley, and he's escorted into another room, carried into another room where he passes away shortly after. But then, yes, a policeman apprehends Audrey Jacob and leads her away.
Well, it seems like an open and shut murder case of a jaded lover to me. But as Dr. Straw explained, there's much more to it than meets the eye.
One of the things that really stood out for me was that it seemed like it was a straightforward, open and shut kind of case. And the police very much looked at it in that way. They thought, here we've got police officers who've rushed to the dance floor. Cyril Gidley has died at the scene. We've got Audrey, as you say, she's standing there with the gun. she's holding the gun. She's got the murder weapon right there. So the police look at this and think, this is going to go to inquest. It'll go through the inquest. She'll be charged with willful murder, which she is, and it'll go to trial. And from their perspective, it was kind of a case that they just couldn't lose because of all the evidence that was there, and it was so straightforward. And I think that's one of the things that really stood out for me going through the records. You go through that progression of the inquest and the evidence that's revealed. But then what we see with the trial is that Cyril Gidley's really turned in a very negative light. And true or not, that's what happened in the case.
So Audrey is holding a smoking gun. The police rock up and she ends up in custody. To understand what happens next, we have to understand an interesting thing called the unwritten law.
Yeah, the unwritten law was very, very interesting because we hadn't used it in the Australian context. It had been used, for example, in France, where you could argue that you were seeking revenge because of perhaps violence that was inflicted against you or some wrongdoing that a partner had committed, and therefore you had your right to seek revenge in relation to that. So this idea of the unwritten law was brought into the trial, and it was sensational in itself, as I say, because it was the first time that this had really been brought through in the Australian courts.
Another interesting factor in this case seems to be the charisma and manipulation of the media by Audrey Jacobs' lawyer.
Now, Arthur Haynes was a lawyer who was quite willing to take on work without full payment. Now, he'd represented a number of the women who worked in the Rowe Street brothels at the same time and who found themselves sometimes going through the courts. And he would often take on cases and either say not to get paid because he thought it was part of his social justice work, or to take a small payment later on. But in terms of who was paying for this, there seems to be some indication that there were some family members, extended family members related to the Jacobs who might have been helping out. Certainly her mum and dad didn't have a great deal of money, so this would have been quite a difficult financial situation for them as well.
Well, yeah, Fremantle was then a very working class community, wasn't it?
Yes, very much so, yeah. I mean, there's that beautiful, you know, Port City and Perth City difference that still exists, I think, today, a bit of the rivalry that's certainly there. And you see it with Fremantle and its working class identity, certainly in the early 20th century, that carries through a lot of the decades that followed from the 1920s as well. He had Audrey Jacob, who was there as a 20-year-old young woman. She's an art student. You have a perfect individual in which to gain the sympathies of the jurors, but also the public at large. And so he really played into her youth and her innocence, her supposed innocence, as he played on. And then he plays into the fact that you've got Cyril Gidley, who has mistreated this young woman, and that she's been devastated by the relationship, its breakup. And then she sees him on the ballroom dance floor having a good time, and she snaps. And so he really plays into that, but he also uses the press as well, as I said before. So he's feeding stories to the Mirror newspaper. That plays into the public sympathy, and he uses that also in the courtroom to play into the sympathies of the 12 jurors who were there. And I've said as well in the book itself that if we were to look at Audrey Jacob perhaps as a young Indigenous woman, I wonder if the outcome would have been the same.
I doubt it would have been in 1920s Perth.
Next station, Perth.
Planet Perth.
Hey, it's Jeff here. I just wanted to take a moment out from chatting with Dr. Lee Straw and Damien to let you know of another great podcast here on RTRFM. It's called Sovereign, and it's a fortnightly podcast by sister girls Charlene and IJ about First Nations news, fashion, culture, and relationships. Go on, subscribe now on iTunes and Spotify, or visit RTRFM's brand spanking new website to stream for free.
Planet Perth.
Lots of interesting evidence was presented as part of Audrey's trial. Back at the State Archives, Damien talks us through it.
This is the bullet casing. So when Audrey Jacob shoots Cyril Gidley at 1:30 in the morning on the 27th of August 1925, the casing actually hit one of the dancers nearby. So she shoots Cyril Gidley through the chest and the bullet casing flies out of the gun and hits a fellow dancer. Now, this is interesting because during the court case...
So, is a pistol not a revolver?
Yes, 25 caliber, pistol. She wasn't aware that she was holding this gun because it was wrapped in a white handkerchief. And then when she shot Cyril Gidley, she was still... The gun was still in this white handkerchief. No one really seemed to see the white handkerchief. And then if it was wrapped up, how could this bullet cartridge eject from the gun?
Yes, correct, yeah. Right.
The white handkerchief was submitted as evidence by Audrey Jacobs' defence lawyer during the case. It wasn't sort of tendered as evidence before that, but he shows this handkerchief with what seemed to be a bullet mark. But he said, oh, unfortunately, the handkerchief had been washed before I could provide it to you, so there's no kind of scorching or gunpowder on this. Again, it kind of begs the question, was the handkerchief
or not? That is such a leap to expect anyone to believe.
This is the program, so this is, you know, the dancers or the music that was played.
Card.
We did get a phone call from the former governor, WA Governor Kim Beazley, once asking about that, because there is this story still at Government House at the ballroom that sometimes late at night the music can still be faintly heard. Part of this file that we only received custody of from the Department of Justice about 5 years ago. So this is the Crown Prosecution file, which contains, you read out of that letter. So this is Cyril Gidley's original letter where a couple of weeks before he was murdered, he writes out that Audrey Jacobs had visited him on his ship down at Fremantle and that she threatened him. And this note is, you know, basically written out in case she does what, keep her vow.
So she he wrote this, it before he got murdered, man. Yeah,
he had this very strong sense that something was about to happen to him.
Wow.
Which is part of the story. It flips the whole narrative on its case,
it
where
sure does.
That he was, you know, this terrible seducer, this vile seducer, and that Audrey was the victim, whereas, you know, as historians have been looking at, you know, he was in threat of his life. You can see the handwriting.
Yes, it's identical.
It's the same. And he's leaving his mother all his goods and effects. But again, you know, as I said the other day, what 25-year-old would be making out of will and probate unless they knew?
That your time might be limited.
Yeah, very unusual.
Can you read what it says, Jeff?
So I give unto my mother, Florence Kate Gidley, all money due to me, including an insurance policy with the Temperance and General Insurance Society Limited Australia, valued at £300 at death, including interest up to my death also. I also give all my personal belongings to my mother to do with as she pleases. With a witness dated the 5th of April, 1925. Seems to be the same writing of Cyril Gidley that he used in a another letter saying he was scared that he was going to be bumped off.
And he was.
He was. Despite the incredible evidence, Audrey's acquittal had everything to do with who was reporting it.
Yes, yeah. I mean, the media was certainly a key character, you might say, in the inquest, but certainly in the trial, because people were getting, the public, the Perth public, are getting their information from the newspapers. And so the manner in which you've got the editor of the Mirror newspaper, who already has this friendship with the defence lawyer, he's getting the stories to him. The defence lawyer, too, was also very critical of other newspapers that were critical of his client as well. So he would march down to the newspaper offices to tell them exactly what he thought. So I think this is one of those cases where sometimes these days we talk about the media and their role in court cases and so on, and perhaps the sensationalism that is there or maybe impacting on the public's view of a particular individual or a group or whoever's going through the court system. This is an example of the fact that it was going on over, you know, 100 years ago.
I still have so many questions, and as Lee explains, because we lack first-hand accounts from Cyril himself, there are still many holes in our historical accounts of what happened.
It's such a fascinating case because of those questions around it, because we don't have Cyril Gidley's perspective, we don't have a lot of information about him because, as I say, he's an immigrant to Western Australia, had only been here 2 years. His family was adamant that how he was being portrayed in the newspaper stories was not actually what he was like. His friends thought that he was being portrayed in a very negative light, and that wasn't how they could recall their friendship with him. Certainties that we have, Audrey Jacobs shot Cyril Gidley dead on the dance floor of Government House. And then what we build from that is trying to work out, why did she do it? I don't know. I've been trying to figure out the intricacies of their relationship, and it's difficult because Audrey's testimony is also helped by a defence lawyer who's helping her with her responses and how she should respond. As much as I've mentioned the sensationalism of the case, I think this is a really interesting example of how you need to look at what the records say to try and interpret what has actually happened. And sometimes we don't have all the answers, but I think it offers us an opportunity to see this was a sensational case for Perth in the 1920s, but it was so sensational because it didn't happen all the time. So that's what really stands out, is this big country town where something incredible has happened in 1925, where you've got this young woman who shot her ex-lover on the dance floor of Government House. It just didn't happen on a regular basis, and so that's where the interest certainly comes in. But what always fascinates me is trying to, outside of the individuals, Audrey Jacob or Cyril Gidley or Arthur Haynes, what fascinates me is that historical imagination of imagining what it was like in Perth in the 1920s.
In the end, Audrey did what most Perthians do. She moved to Melbourne to escape the spotlight. Then, a mere 6 months later, she married a wealthy businessman and moved to New York. It marked the start of a new life for the young girl who quite literally got away with murder. A big thank you to Damon Hassan and Dr. Lee Straw for joining us on Planet Perth. My name is Jeff Bullen, and I'm your host. Our wonderful assistant producer is Siobhan Dale, and our executive producer is Danielle Raphael, who also edits this podcast. Our theme music is Can't Blame the City by local band The Mackerels, with artwork by Hannah Coakley. If you'd like to get in touch with an interesting story for us to cover, you can reach us at talks@rtrfm.com.au. Next time, we're taking a trip to one of Perth's most controversial amusement parks, Ugly Land.
In some ways, it was a venue that brought people together, but in other ways, it also just reflected back the prejudices of the time.
Thank you for listening to this RTRFM podcast. RTRFM is a community organisation and relies on volunteer and listener support. Visit rtrfm.com.au for more podcasts and other great content, as well as details on how you can support the station. You can also download our app and access RTRFM anytime and anywhere on your mobile device.